The greatest of all 20th century cultural impresarios died 75 years ago this year, Sergei Pavlovich Diaghilev, and we're still celebrating his imperial legacy. Ballets by Fokine, Nijinska, and Massine, scores commissioned from Debussy, Ravel, Prokofiev, Satie, Poulenc, and above all, Igor Stravinsky, five of whose ballets for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe are being played at this year's proms. There were painters who designed for the company too, from Bakst to Benoit, from Picasso to Matisse. And one dance above all that changed the public perception of classical dance forever, the Rite of Spring. Stravinsky's music caused a scandal. Nijinsky's choreography horrified purists with turned-in, not turned-out feet. And then there were Nicholas Roeric's costumes, Russian and primitive. This costume here was created for one of the maidens in the Rite of Spring. It's in the Theatre Museum, which is part of the Victoria and Albert Museum. And here to talk about it is Sarah Woodcock, curator at the Theatre Museum. Sarah, it's the sheer simplicity, first of all, of this costume. It's a kind of shift, really, down to the ankles.
Yes, in fact, it wouldn't have been down to the ankles originally. It would have been bunched up around the waist with a little leather belt from which would hang little amulets. But so that we can see the design prom in its full glory, we've left the belt off for today. Yes, it is. It's basically just the T-shape that is the most primitive of shift shapes. This one's slightly different in that it's got fuller arms than usual, and they're graduated into what would have fitted closely onto the wrists. So, but underneath, they've got the little coloured insets, which again is very characteristic of the primitive costumes.
It's, of course, the colour that just simply takes your breath away. Even the little colour insets below the arm are a kind of brilliant orange.
Yes.
It's reds, yellows, purples, aquamarines.
Maroons.
It glows.
Turquoise is really sort of almost fluorescent-y colours in some cases. The colour is one of the things, of course, that the Diaghilev Ballet's major impact on Europe was in its sheer colour and its uninhibited use of colour. And I think those are the two words that most sum up what he brought. To a world that had become very beige, very sort of lavender and genteel, both in Paris and in London. So yes, this sort of thing has a huge visual impact. It must have been like looking through the wrong end of a kaleidoscope at the first performance. I mean, this is only one of many designs. There were 10 maidens, 10 women, there were three of these costumes and sort of seven of another. So the whole thing was asymmetric as well. It wasn't sort of evenly balanced groups. Choreography was asymmetric. And when you add that to the music with those sheer pounding rhythms, it must have been just overwhelming. And I think that's what happened to that first audience. It was just like being shot at, you know, it was really horrendous.
You talk about asymmetry, but in fact the geometrical patterns on the costume itself, the squares, the circles, right. The crosses, the dots, the diamonds, they're very symmetrical,
aren't
they?
Yes, each costume is symmetrical within that. I think if it wasn't, it would just have become totally, a total mess. But no, that's a sort of defining still center, if you like, within all this mayhem that's going on stage and in the audience.
And of course, we need to remember...
In Paris.
We need to remember that this costume would have been seen in movement.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the problems with the theatre costumes. They're taken out of their context and they become something else entirely. So everybody looks at them as art objects. If I have another museum doing an exhibition on Diaghilev and the artists as though he was an art movement, I'm going to go spare because, of course, he was a theatre movement. And this theatre is the point at which art becomes transmitted down to a much wider base, to a much wider audience. You know, art galleries, you don't need many visitors. Theatre, you've got to fill a theatre, so you've got to have a number of like-minded people. So it's very good for filtering new ideas when they're sort of stop being cutting edge and are ready for transmission to a wider audience.
I'm also puzzled by the necklace around.
Yes.
That seems to be attached to the costume.
Yes, it is. It's stitched down. The central medallion is stitched down. You couldn't have them flying up around the dancer in movement. But these are loose. These aren't supposed to be attached. So, yes, there would have been a certain amount of jangling and other noise that would be adding on stage, anyway, to the sheer mayhem of noise on stage. Because it wasn't just the music. The dancers were hitting the floor. They were pounding the floor with different rhythms, often opposed to the music, I'm sure. The counts were being shouted at them from the wings because they couldn't hear the orchestra in the premiere because of the riot. A little jangling around the neck wasn't going to be making much difference. And most of the dancers hated it anyway.
I have to say, for me, the most touching, the moment where I feel I'm close to the historical moment that was the early first performances in Paris of The Rite of Spring, was when I look at the neck and I can see that there's a little repair where perhaps a dancer in fury or something had torn off the costume, which perhaps is by the wardrobe.
There are lots of little repairs all over costumes, and it's quite difficult to sort of work out whether they're what we should term historic and important, or whether they're just cobbling together at a later date. But the costumes, though there were very few performances of the Nijinsky Ballet, there were four performances in Paris, three in London. Later, Léonie Massine did new choreography for it in the 1920s, so there was a little more use. But yes, sort of people tearing costumes on and off, you know, you're doing three ballets in an evening, mayhem of the dressing rooms, which probably aren't big enough. Yeah, accidents happen.
Now, what do we know about Nicholas Roerich, who designed this costume and designed the first Rite of Spring?
Well, Roerich is one of the Russian painters at the end of the 19th century who's in rebellion against the intense realism of the previous generation. This is going on all over Europe. I think it's easy to think that this is something in isolation, but it's not. Every country is having this revolution of the young people against the old. And Roerich is one of the... Roerich's particular speciality was a study of ancient Russia and the primitive tribes and peoples. Not much was known about them, so you have to work very imaginatively through the few artifacts that are left. He only really did Prince Igor and Rite of Spring for Diaghilev, because I say those are the two ethnic tribal ballets.
Prince Igor is, of course, the opera that Diaghilev brings in first visit to Paris, which really sets people back.
The Borodin opera, and it has this great dance sequence in the middle, which is the slaves, and it's one of the entertainments for the captured prince. And Polotsian dances actually is one thing that sets Paris alight in that first season, I think. Again, it's Roerich's designs, wonderful Ikat fabrics, which are native to Russia, native to Uzbekistan. Wonderful weaving patterns of great scallops and swathes of color again. And again, it was the uninhibited barbarism of Fokine's choreography and of the men's performances. Nijinsky was not really the great sensation of that first season. Adolf Bohm was, who danced the Polotsian dances.
Roerich had been a friend, a colleague of Diaghilev's for some way back. Indeed, the two of them had worked on that celebrated magazine, The World of Art, which was a kind of series of manifestos about a new way of looking at the arts in a kind of complete sense.
That's right. I think there was a new burgeoning of interest in cross-fertilization of the arts at this point. And it's especially true of ballet, of course, because it involves the three arts. It involves music, it involves movement, it involves design. So it's a very good medium for sort of trying out new things, new experiments. Again, that was going on in cultures throughout Europe. But yes, World of Art's very important. Yes, it is. It's a manifesto for the new artists against, again, the old generation. And it's very influenced by a lot of other European art. Aubrey Beardsley has a huge influence on the sheer quality and the design factor within the magazine. And it's aiming really at, I think, I hate using the words emotional truth. The previous generation had been a depiction of the world, realism. Now what you're looking at is a sort of emotional much response to things, I think, very much. And simplification, that's the other thing.
So when we look at this costume, we should see then perhaps this as being about emotion rather than an attempt by Roerich to carefully reproduce what he's discovered about ethnic fabrics, ethnic pattern making for fabrics.
I think it's a mixture of the two things. I think, after all, there's not a huge amount known. I don't know how much he had to base facts on. But primitive design is pretty similar across the world. It's one of the things he found out when he started to look at it, that really it's pretty similar. And after all, what are basic designs? Wavy lines, straight lines, squares, circles. You know, they're fairly basic to all cultures, if you pick up a pencil, you know, and doodle. Though he puts it together in quite a sophisticated way. But colour, yes, is immensely important to him. And of course, a lot of artists, and if you look at a lot of art criticism, talks about painting in terms of music. It talks of harmony and construction and symmetry and harmony and colour. Some painters and musicians see in colour. Nicholas Georgiadis, the great designer in the 20th century, saw very much in terms of music, in terms of colour.
But there's dissonance here too, isn't there? If you look at those on the sleeves, the triangles with the aquamarine
colour,
they clash wonderfully,
don't they? That's right. And of course, you've no way of knowing how this all looked under the lights and en masse. But this, I think, ties into similar colours used on other costumes as well. You know,
is that sense of dissonance, of clash, again part of perhaps a wider movement, which is in the early 20th century a desire to escape what are thought of the refined traditions of Western art, Western painting, a desire to incorporate, I use the word advisedly and with inverted commas, the primitive.
There's certainly a greater awareness of the primitive, I think, that comes in towards the end of the 19th century. After all, it's the age when people really become aware of, I'm talking about the average person, becomes aware of abroad. I think that happens at the beginning of the century. And the opening out of Africa, of course, and African culture, and the starting of your starting sciences of the 20th century, archaeology, or starting anthropology studies, and so on. I think it's all part of that. I don't think that it's really anything. So we are getting a lot of new influences in, but it's difficult to say how much it's conscious to say we went in deliberately to make it different. Stravinsky's doing something he feels he wants to do,
but is he
which
proposing,
happens to tie into the time.
But is he proposing, Stravinsky and indeed Rurik and others, a kind of critique of civilized, perhaps decadent values in Western society?
Oh, I'm sure that's what comes in, because that's what every younger generation thinks it's doing, to be honest. I mean, that's why they're called revolutions. They just come around again. But it's very difficult to say how... that's a Terry Pratchett quote, I hate. It's very, very difficult to actually say this, because you just don't know how people... It's easy to look back and say, that's what I was doing. But at the time, you're just living your life and getting on with what you feel. And the people we remember are the people who best encapsulate and make into an icon the changes that are happening. Stravinsky is very much one of them.
Do we know...
It's being there at the right time.
Do we know what the dancers felt about having to wear this costume?
They hated it. They hated the ballet. I mean, don't forget, these were dancers trained very much in the classical ballets, like Swan Lake. And they'd already gone through the revolution of Fokine's choreography, which is very much, you use classical technique and classically trained dancers because they can move so well, but you're making them do very different things. And it's one thing dancing to, say, the Firebird, which was pretty revolutionary for a lot of them. Pavlova refused to be in it. That's when she walked out, when she thought she was going to have to dance to that.
Yes, of course, it's Stravinsky's first score.
Stravinsky's first score for Diaghilev. They were all used to nice little waltzes, mazurkas, something very simple. So faced with this, they hadn't got a clue how to go about it. Neither had Nijinsky. And that's why Diaghilev brought in Marie Rombert. Rombert had been trained by Jacques Dalcroze, who had developed this extremely efficient way of teaching movement and rhythm through the body, so that, in fact, different parts of the body reacted in different ways. And it's interesting that both Marie Rombert and Ninette de Valois were both Dalcroze aficionados. And it's a very good way of teaching dancers to respond to music and rhythm. So she was brought in to help Nijinsky with it and just work their way through it. So the dancers hated it. As you said, they were all turned in rather than turned out. The hands were like that for a lot of the time.
So your hand one kind of poking your cheek and the other across your... almost as if they were leaning on their elbows.
That's right. That's one of the famous poses, one of the only images we have of it. They didn't like that. It was very complicated to do. And these costumes, which in fact, this looks quite lightweight, it is in fact wool. Bunched up around your waist. Heated the stage lights. These lights are bad enough. Battery of stage lighting. You're sweating like mad. You're having to concentrate like mad trying to hear the orchestra and count. You're trying to count yourself. Anybody who's seen Les Noces at Covent Garden, if you're close enough, you can hear the dancers almost counting, because that, again, is immensely complicated. That's another Stravinsky score. So they loathed the whole thing. They were hot. The men had a worse time. Their costumes were even heavier. And they were, again, bunched up around the waist. And to get the belts on, to get them into a proper shape, they had to put in cotton bands around the center, because otherwise they just wouldn't have been able to move, and the fabric would have looked crunchy. And
so it was even thicker by the time they put cotton bands
even
on.
Even thicker.
And they were even hotter.
The men were really having a bad time of it, yes. And you had wigs and you had hats on, and it was a nightmare. It was chaos on stage.
We have virtually no idea, though people have endeavoured to recreate Nijinsky's original choreography for those first performances,
yes, right.
But we really don't know much about it. But do we know what the starting point for this extraordinary new way of shaping classical dance was for Nijinsky?
Are you asking me to tell the story about the duck? As you know, in Paris there was a riot on the first night. In London, London audience is very well behaved, they got a lecture. Diaghilev brought on a music critic called Edwin Evans to explain the ballet to the audience. And Evans had known Diaghilev and Nijinsky really from the early seasons. And he always said Nijinsky had quite a childish streak in him. And he one day saw a toy duck in a shop. I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it had triangular wheels. I don't know whether the feet flapped up and down going round. I don't know whether the wings moved. But after the first night of, after Rite of Spring, Mishinsky dashed up to Edwin Evans and said, did you recognise it? And Evans said, what? And Mishinsky said, I got most of the movements from the duck. Now, that is a story which shocks some people. It's ballet. He's a genius. That's where it all starts. You know, that's where it can start. Obviously, there were other factors involved. But
what do you think it was that really did shock that first Parisian audience?
Well, it takes a lot to shock a Paris audience, but they do like a nice scandal and a nice riot. I mean, they rioted on the first night of L'Après-midi d'Enfant, of course, as well. I think it was just, as I said, we can't think now what it must have been like to sit in on that first. It must have sounded like pure cacophony, I think, to a lot of people. It was, as you said, total antithesis to. I mean, they hadn't been doing classical ballet all the time. By 1913, very few of Diaghilev's ballets were being performed on point. In fact, they are on flat feet, or so they were used to that. I just think it's the combination. The combination of the sound, this very strange music, the sound, the kaleidoscopic.
Do you think
design.
It was also the subject matter? I mean, after all, there in the audience was one of the most hierarchical societies in Western Europe, where people genuinely still knew their place up and down. And what they were being shown was another hierarchical society on stage that culminates in a murder. You know, in a sense, it becomes a terrifying, dark version of their own world.
Oh, that's very deep. That's very Freudian. I don't think I can go into that one. I think that might be looking back with hindsight. I just think it was just the sheer strangeness of it that on one level got to them. And once somebody starts shouting, the rest of the audience will do it. It's possible Diaghilev planted people, for all we know.
Well, it was, of course. It was, of course, very much to his taste. There's a story
Absolutely.
Of him consoling Stravinsky, who was desolated by what had happened, by putting his arm around him, his shoulder, and saying, just what I wanted.
Just what I wanted, exactly. There's nothing like a good scandal for publicity. Free. It's all free, you see. They don't pay for it.
Sarah, how did this wonderful costume find its way to the Victorian Albert Museum, to the Theatre Museum?
Well, I will say here and now it's only one of about 500 Diaghilev costumes that we have. That includes the shoes. It's quite complicated, actually. After Diaghilev died, a lot of his repertory and costumes were taken over by the other companies that we now know as the Ballet Russe companies, especially the de Basel Ballet. De Basel Ballet is hugely influential in the 1930s in really spreading ballet across, again, a really wide range of the population. It certainly was never elitist, and so as people now like to think of it. And that company really went on till about 1950, by which point it was a very, very sad shadow of what it had been. And the costumes all went into store in Paris. And then in the 1960s, the owner of the costumes decided to sell them. And they were sold in a series of highly spectacular and publicized sales at Sotheby's. And Richard Buckle, the expert on Diaghilev, who did the wonderful 1954 Diaghilev exhibition, which really promotes Diaghilev as an icon, as we now accept him, Buckle was brought in to do the cataloguing. And he suddenly realized that these costumes, he thought, who's going to buy them? Where are they going to go? And he clubbed together with a lot of friends to get money to buy them, to found a Museum of the Performing Arts. And he bought a whole lot. Later, other people who'd bought gave him their costumes. I mean, what do you do with a costume like this in your own home? Having said which, one person who has a Matisse costume has got it as framed as a room divider. Some people have more money than sense. And so he acquired a lot more, and eventually they did come to what is now the Theatre Museum, which Dickie had a big hand in establishing.
Sarah Woolcock, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.